Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. Bristol Community FM has taken us off the air, but we'll be back middle, end of April. Apparently, according to the station manager, Pat Hart, hopefully you're hearing this on BCFM now. This week, we talk to Anthony Palmer, former Forces soldier who was trained, proper Forces training, and then he found himself homeless with his young son. Also to Steve Norman, who's been helping him live in a squatted house, one the council in Avonmouth is trying to sell off. Also this week, Barry Wynn, the second part of the three-part series, talking to him. It was his father that helped Montgomery do his supplies in the Second World War. Barry went on, as you will hear this week, to survive an attack in London during the Blitz from a V2, Nazi bomb, and also then after the war, because he survived that, to help set up the first commercial station in London, ATV. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. Could you introduce yourself and tell us about your housing situation at the moment?
Yeah, hi. My name's Anthony Palmer, and currently I am staying in a hostel down on North Street, which, you know, I don't think is fit to, you know, habitate animals.
Oh, really? Good. Tell us about the accommodation that you're given as a homeless person.
Well, you know, I've got my 20-month-year-old son with me in my full-time care, and well, you know, a box room in a small council house is probably bigger than what I've got. You know, I've had cockroaches, I've had threats, people carving in my door. You know, there's living alongside people just getting out of prison. You know, they've housed a prostitute in there. You know, and my son's gets woken up all night. You know, I haven't even got a bath. The bathman, he suffers real bad with his eczema. You know, it's, you know, I don't know how anyone can cope. You know, I'm struggling big time with it.
So you're almost on the edge of actually living on the street. So how did you become homeless in the first place?
Well, you know, I was working, and, you know, I used to, you know, stay at like a family member's house and pay rent for a room, you know, and I've always sort of either lived with friends or always independently on my own and paid a part towards a rent as such for a room. You know, because I never ever been on a council list. I never thought I'd ever get anywhere as a single man. And, you know, I was happy being in private renting. And unfortunately, you know, I got into a situation where, you know, I wasn't with my son's mother, and, you know, he was taken into care. And, you know, I had to make a big decision, but, you know, I decided to step up to the mark. I wanted to take on my son full time. Part of taking on my son full time, I couldn't keep the job I had as you know, a forklift driver down on the docks. So I couldn't do the hours as well as look after my son.
And so this is a difficult decision, isn't it, for a lot of men and women? Often it's you know, do I care for my kids or do I have a job? And that's a difficult decision to make sometimes. I mean, surely it's most important you look after your own children, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you know, my son wasn't asked to be born, and he deserved to grow up with, you know, knowing his real parents. And so I took the decision to, go through the courts, and you know, I got him out of foster care, and because he was up for an adoption. And then shortly after, you know, the family member I was with, she only had a one-bedroom house with an attic, which, you know, the attic, by the council and the standards, it's not classed as a room, so... Therefore, you know, social services, I wouldn't have been happy with me staying there. And I was put up temporarily by another family member. But, you know, I've got a young son, and, you know, they had kids, my other family member. They just couldn't cope. You know, they couldn't afford to house me or keep me anymore. And, you know, so I needed something of my own. And so, yeah, I turned to the council for help. And, I got put in down in this hostel.
Okay, but you decided that hostel, you wanted to make a stand, really, to say, well, actually, I think I need a bit better accommodation than this. And so you've taken a bit of action, haven't you?
Well, yes. You know, I was never getting anywhere with the council. I was just always getting thrown backwards and forwards by switchboards and that, you know. And, you know, I haven't got masses of money. I'm working class. So, you know, spending £20 trying to ring the council on top-ups, you know, and not getting anywhere and not getting any responses, you know, and the dire state I was left in, and, you know, the building's falling apart, you know, there's nowhere for my son to play. And it got to a stage where, you know, something had to be done. And it's not just me, there's thousands of hundreds of families in, you know, certain situations like myself.
Well, I mean, let's look at the figures, because Bristol's got somewhere between 15 and 20,000 people on the housing list. So that's the number of people who are officially classed as homeless. That is to say, they're either in overcrowded conditions or they're in accommodation that's not suitable, one sort or another, or else they're sleeping on the streets. Were you ever close to that?
Well, yeah, I've been very close to that, you know. And at one stage, I thought I was going to be close to that, because when my, you know, my family member asked me to move out, she couldn't cope anymore with me being there. You know, I went to the council, and at first they said it was, you know, I had to go from South Bristol, Avonmouth, to Temple Street, you know, with one bag of clothing and my son on public transport. This is at 3:30 in the afternoon. I had to be there by 4:30. The council wouldn't help me and should be shutting up. So I was told that I needed to find somewhere to stay for the night. So they wasn't even an out-of-hours team to even help me with that. You know, I had to go beg a friend to stay on their sofa with my son. You know, the company that, you know, the council is a private company that puts that, you know, the council's paying for me to be in this hostel. And you know, let's face it, they're paying £260 a week for me to stay in a room, which, like I said, is no bigger than a box room, the smallest room in the house. You know, when, you know, a flat is £80, a two-bedroom flat with the council is £80 a week, and this company's making thousands off of the council out of homelessness and poor people's misery. And not only that, after three and a half, four months of being there, council just bought in service charges, which I have to now pay £70 a month to stay there. And like I said, I had cockroaches for 4 weeks, you know, I've had threats, I've been wrongly accused of things. Like, you know, I had a neighbour decided to ring up and put in complaints about me, which saying I was playing loud music, and I don't even own a stereo, to be honest with you, I haven't got stereo. And rather than someone coming out, I got a 28-day written warning and an eviction note. And, you know, I had to get the council out, I had to get the owners of this building, and, you know, I put all the things that they said apparently I've done wrong, which wasn't true, you know. Obviously, I addressed it, and they just decided to withdraw. But the warning, but just feels like they look for excuses to kick you out so they can get the next lot of poor people in, and, you know, and then the council can lose their obligation to you. And, you know, I have been threatened with that for a couple of times, and I've done nothing wrong. I've just trying to get a house for my son.
So you've ended up in Avonmouth. Where and how's that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of movements and a lot of political protests going on at the moment. You know, it's a big thing about homelessness in Bristol. And, you know, I approached a family member for help, and they had a few contacts. And then, you know, we found that there was an empty council house. So to make my voice heard and to make homelessness people's voices heard, you know, we've done a political protest and, you know, managed to get access to the property, you know, and, you know, it's highlighted my case to the council, but they seem to not really want to be doing anything or in a move to try and help.
So have they actually offered you anywhere since this? Because, I mean, you've been in the news. You were actually top of the bulletin, I think, last week sometime, where they were saying there's an ex-forces chap and his young son who have taken over one of these council houses the council's trying to sell.
Yeah, well, I had a meeting actually, you know, earlier on today, and, well, let me say, the council come back with, they've offered me still temporary accommodation. It's not a council place. you know, a place in a hostel closer to, you know, where my support networks are. And by all means, they've said it's a lot nicer. It's actually a one-bedroom flat with space, so, you know, I can store my son's toys somewhere. You know, I haven't got half his possessions at my sister's and at my mum's and here, there and everywhere. And they offered me that in one hand, but then in the next breath, they turned around and said it's full up and there's no spaces in there. So, you know, I might be getting it offered maybe in weeks to come, but how long's a piece of string, you know? That's basically what I've been left. So I've just been left out in the cold, and obviously I don't know what to think anymore.
So what's this place that you've been living out in Avonmouth? What's that like?
Well, it's an empty two-bedroom council house, you know, and the council said it was up for auction because it was in a bad state of disrepair. And I could tell you what, I went in there and they've put a brand new kitchen in there. There's a brand new wet room upstairs with a brand new bathing facilities. You know, there's nicely plastered walls, painted magnolia.
So the big cracks in the walls and things?
Oh, no, there's nothing wrong apart from the teeny little bit of damp in this council house, like a teeniest little bit, which is manageable with, you know, easily manageable. You know, the house is in perfect condition. You know, a family of three or four could move in there tomorrow and it would be a perfect setup. But apparently this house is in a desperate state of disrepair. And, you know, when there's a crisis like we got and there's people screaming out for houses and there ain't even enough houses in the private sector either, you know, you're thinking, hang on a minute, what's going on with the council? Is this just a profit business for them, or, you know, people's misery they're making profit from?
You're obviously thinking quite a lot about commendable, really, not just your own situation. There's thousands of other people in the same situation. What do you think the solution is?
Well, I mean, obviously it's not going to be something that's solved overnight, you know. It is a very, very big situation going on, but, you know, if they could just stop selling these houses off and these council properties. And, you know, I'd happily, if there was a council property, and needed a bit of work done, you know, I'd happily move in and, you know, the council could come out and, or, you know, it could get sorted out within time. You know, it's not, you know, because, you know, it's hard to explain, but why sell off these houses for, you know, some private firm or some private, you know, property management development manager to do it up and make a killing off of it?
What would you say to people that say, well, actually, what you should really do is you should get a job and you should get enough money to put down a deposit maybe on a private rented house?
You know, well, that is a fair question. And, you know, if I had the support, because obviously I'm a single father on my own now, and if I had the support to be able to work, I mean, I've got my forklift licenses, and, you know, I was in the army a few years back, you know, and I can get a job. It's not a problem getting a job, and I'd happily work, and I've always worked most of my life. But I've now turned to a government and a council that I've always paid taxes to for help, because I'm in a situation where until my son's eligible to be able to go back to nursery, I can't work at the moment. Plus, you know, he's just come out of care and he was thrown backwards and forwards and had different foster carers. And, you know, I'm trying to give him stability and, you know, he's not had the stability or the start to life that he needs. And by me, you know, trying to ship him off to a nursery and going to work, you know, that ain't going to solve or help my son in the same light as I wouldn't be able to afford to pay for full-time nursery, you know, if I got a job, as well as rent privately, because let's face it, all these private rents now, you know, the rents are rocketing, and, you know, there's people in good paid jobs that sometimes are struggling with their housing. You know, it's not just working class, you're getting, you know, people a bit above that, you know, that's getting into financial difficulties. And it's like a vicious loophole, you know. Plus, you know, there's no stability of private rent because, you know, a landlord can turn around and be like, you know, 6 months' time, right? Sorry, you know, I'm selling a house on them and they will, you know, or I'm getting in new tenants and they didn't renew your contract. I'm going to be back in the same situation as what I'm in now.
Now, the army trained you in a profession, I think it's to do with logistics or something. What was it?
It was engineering, the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers.
So is there any help from the army of people like you that end up, I mean, you're not the only one, are you, who's ended up finding it difficult to make ends meet, needing somewhere to live?
You know, there is, you know, the odd organisation, you know, I think there's SAFA and that. But, you know, it seems like the council, they said, because I left the army over 5 years ago, they've brought in their own set of criteria, which basically says, you know, they can't help me because I left over 5 years ago, you know, and obviously, you know, there's people obviously in the armed forces that, you know, they've been abroad, they've got mental health conditions, and, you know, some get help, some don't. But
so the council are more likely to help someone who's ex-forces if they've left the forces within 5 years, but you've gone over that limit. So you've kind of fallen between the sort of protection layer. You've now fallen down. They're not going to help you.
I've put the point towards as well, as I left the army, you know, I was on the reservist list for 5 years. So, you know, up to 2 years ago, I could, you know, if we went to war, I would have been one of the first people to be called up, and I would happily fight for my country. You know, I'm trained to fight for my country. And, you know, but what, you know, it feels I've got to a stage now, why would I want to fight for a country that can't even help me when I've hit a hard place in my life? You know, my son, you know, I want to do everything I can for him, but it feels like my hands are tied behind my back and I've just got to put up and shut up. So this is why I've taken, you know, some of the action I've taken, and I'm trying to highlight these problems because they need to be addressed. You know, you can't keep going on ignoring people, putting people, you know, in slums and in property that is not fit for, you know, a family, and cramped conditions. You know, I'm living out of bags. You know, I haven't got space to put my son's clothes anywhere. You know, there's two washing machines per like 30, 40 families. It's like, you know, I get 2 hours a week to do all my washing. You know, it's like, we haven't even got a laundrette, or, you know, the same company, mind, is just making millions off the council a year. They've got land everywhere, land at the back of the building where I'm staying. And it's a rubble site. They can't even put a little grassed area for the kids to play on, you know. It's, you know, and you know, the owner is driving around in a white Lamborghini. Do you know, it's like, and they're charging, you know, more than what, you know, a private person would charge for a flat. Like, you know, it's ridiculous. I don't know how they're getting away with it for so long.
Give you the top job, if you were Prime Minister, what would you do to change things?
Well, you know, I'd stop selling off council houses. That's got to be a must, you know. We need to retain some sort of housing stock and social housing, because, you know, there's people that, you know, can't afford sometimes to go private, or, you know, struggle, or might need the extra support. You know, that we have, you know, like any city, you know, there is vulnerable people. And I think that'd be the first thing. The second thing, I think I would, you know, I'd go around, I'd ask people, what do they feel? How do they feel about, you know, the homelessness situations?
Well, I think most people would say that it's a terrible scar on society, and that if a society can't house its vulnerable people or poor people, then what is the value of that society? It doesn't reflect very well on its leaders.
Yeah, and you know, and I do know there's people that play the system. You know, there is people that play the system, and, you know, they just don't want, they want something for nothing. And I understand that our government had to try and address that, which I think they have done very well. But there's also people that, you know, that have worked most of their life, like myself, and, you know, and I would happily pay to go private. I just found myself in a situation where I couldn't afford it. And, you know, but it feels like I've been tarred with that same brush, and it feels like the government looks at the working class, or looks at people that need the help, and they just think, oh, they're just trying to grab money for nothing, you know, what have they ever done, like, blah, 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 and now we'll take away from them. And it feels like the government just wants to put it back into the middle class and above.
Well, it seems almost as if they're pointing the finger of blame for society's ills at the people who are the most vulnerable.
Yeah, and, you know, and it feels that way. It does feel that way, you know. And why would, you know, like, for instance, why would someone want to fight for a country where when you need help or you turn for help, it's not there? You know, it's like they've taken away everything from, you know, your working class, your people on your council estates. It's like they've took everything away, and they've taxed everything and made everything so hard now that, you know, we're going to be having 10 English people living in two-bedroom flats, like, you know, because they're going to have to split the rent 10 ways because they won't be able to afford to live.
What do you think of the prospects for your son?
You know, if I could get on a plane and go to Australia or get out of this country, I would. I think personally, I'm worried for his future. Obviously, I'm going to try my best to make sure he gets everything he needs and he is successful and he doesn't fall into the same situation that I'm currently in. But I think that the gap between, you know, the lower, like, you know, the poorer in society and the richer in society is getting so big to the point, you know, I think if he doesn't say make a success of himself and get a high paying job, eventually we're going to have trailer parks springing up everywhere like America, ain't we? And, you know, we're going to have caravan sites everywhere and people's going to be living in squalor. That's how it's going, I believe.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Could you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your involvement with the housing action?
Yep, my name is Steve Norman and I'm currently in occupation of 44 Richmond Terrace, Avonmouth, which was one of the 15 houses that went up for auction on April 20th. And I've got no intention of leaving at this moment in time.
So how can a house be sold? I mean, surely these houses are sold vacant possession. If there's somebody in there, then the person who's bought it hasn't actually been sold what they've bought.
Well, you would think so, Tony, but it seems that Bristol City Council gave an undertaking to buyers that they would clear the houses of any squatters, clean up any rubbish they left behind, but they would not pay for any repairs. But in the case of 44 Richmond Terrace, there is no rubbish to clear out and there are no damage, so it's purely a political protest.
So can you tell me the background to this? Because we've got elections coming up, haven't we?
We have. We've got the local and the mayoral and crime commissioner. The background is we have a major housing crisis in Bristol, and yet here we have the city council selling off council houses with the mayor claiming that these houses are beyond economical repair or in a state of disrepair. Well, I think anyone that's seen the videos that we put out regarding 44 Richmond Terrace, it's just a lie. The man's an absolute liar. And at the end of the day, you've only got to look at the video. They sent the maintenance squad went in before it went to auction. It was all decorated out, nice brand new bathroom and suite, what have you, fitted, nice new kitchen fitted. And, you know, somebody's bought this at auction for $140,000.
Now, the mayor would say, and has said, and does say, that this money is being reinvested into housing to build new housing.
Poor peacock. What are you going to build? I think the sale made $3.2 million. So you buy the land, he's got to find the land.
Well, the council have got their own land.
Well, okay, so they've got their own land and they're going to build how many houses for $3.2 million? Not a lot. And then you have to look at the bigger picture. When they're built, who's going to be able to afford the rents? Because they're not going to be cheap. Who's going to build them? Bovis? A private contractor, so they're going to want the share of the houses to sell.
Now, I know you're in touch with Nick Hooper, aren't you? He's got two roles in Bristol City Council as an officer. He's not only the head of housing.
It's crime reduction.
But it's also crime reduction. Now, there's a bit of a problem here, isn't there? Because he is also increasing, under his watch, almost quadrupling the number of people sleeping on the streets in the city.
There's a massive homeless crisis that he's created. You've got, in effect, defunct department. In terms of crime reduction, that's debatable. You're forcing people onto the streets. What's the first thing they're going to turn to? Probably drugs and alcohol. So it's probably increasing crime in that sphere in the city. But let's look at his housing record. What record? As I said, we've got a massive, massive homelessness situation in Bristol, the selling of council houses on the pretense that they're beyond economical repair. Only today I became aware of three other council houses that are going to be released by me at a very opportune moment, which is going to be tomorrow. And I'm looking forward to George's response, because he is going to be caught right on the back foot. So I found three. So how many more throughout the city that are empty, being run down, and they're being run down to be sold? We are heading towards private housing all the time in Bristol. It's only a matter of...
I mean, sorry, Steve, but this is a national government policy, isn't it? It's not really Ferguson's fault or Nick Cooper's fault. It's Cameron who's decided he wants to go for private-only housing, effectively getting rid of things like social housing and affordable housing, which, it, by the way, is not affordable.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is a thing driven by the Tories. But at the end of the day, at this moment in time, It's not 100% policy. You know, you've got a young man with a young child living in a free pit of a hostel, and then you've got a two-bed council house, ideal for the man, right near where his support network is, and you've got someone buys it for 140,000. You know, give it away.
Now, with back to Nick Hooper, the officer of the council who's in charge of housing, I mean, he's had a pretty dismal record over the last few years. We've seen a massive increase in homelessness and no apparent reduction in crime in the city centre. So has he had a pay cut?
Oh, he's had a pay rise. I mean, he's been honoured with an 18% pay rise.
Do we know how much he's on now?
I think he was on about region of about 80,000 prior to the pay rise. So we're probably looking around between the 80 and the 100,000 a year mark. Nice work if you can get it. You don't have to do nothing. Sit in an office, let people become homeless, let crime increase, and draw your salary.
Okay, Steve. Well, I mean, sort of barrack room lawyer point of view, what would you like to see done by the city council?
Well, in this moment in time, I'd like to see a guarantee, not only from this mayor, that no more council houses will be sold, something that George is not going to give, but more importantly, let's look at it realistically, George's popularity in this city is very low. It's very doubtful that he's going to get re-elected and bar a ballot box rigging. So let's look at the incoming, most likely incoming mayor, which is probably going to be Marvin. Marvin was screaming recently at George, stop the sale. So I want to know from Marvin, there's almost a certainty looking like I'm still going to be in occupation of the morning of the 6th of May. Is he going to withdraw this house from council from the start? Is he going to void the sale?
So, I mean, it's an interesting situation because the house has been sold, but the city council have still not evicted you from it. So they haven't really done their deal with the person that's bought it.
We've had no contact from the city council whatsoever. We've had no legal threats from them in terms of eviction.
So where's the buyer due to get the deeds to the house?
Well, on the email that was kindly sent to me by Mr. Hooper, I believe completion date is the 18th of May. Well, okay, that being the case and being the fact this is not a squat, and I must stress, this is not a squat, it's a political occupation because it's the only way the working class, such as myself, and those that are not strong enough to have a voice, can get our voice heard. And on that basis, the new legislation introduced by the Tories does not come into play. And it would be my intention to leave on the 19th of May, which is the day after their completion date. Well, that being the case, where does the buyer stand? Good question. But then in the same context, why would anyone want to purchase a house with people in occupation?
So have you spoken to the buyer? Do you know who they are?
I do know who the buyer is. I found out who the buyer is today. It's a young lady called Miss Zoe Stockbrook, I think it is, or Stonebrook. So I don't know what she's been told by the city council, but from the evidence I have or obtained, is it's almost certainly she's paid for the house in full.
Sounds to me like a bit of a cack-handed way to sell off council property.
It doesn't. Well, it was cack-handed from start to finish. I mean, one, you shouldn't be selling council property. This is not a right to buy situation. This is auctioning off perfectly good housing stock that some of the homeless could take occupation in or build a home in. Is purely put it into the private sector for the profiteers, which is George's. That is what George Ferguson is all about, profit. He's a merchant venturer. He knows no other mindset.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
So we go over to hear from Barry Wynn now. This is a second part of a three-part interview that I did with Barry. Barry, his father, was one of the major figures in the Second World War, helping Montgomery get his supplies to North Africa, because, of course, the Al Alamein battle was actually one of the first that Britain won in the Second World War. It was one of the turning points of the war. Barry was working in a perfume factory during the war, and as you're going to hear, he also nearly got killed by a V2 bomb. But we begin by talking about the whole situation with Russia today. I mean, today we see the Russians apparently as still a kind of an adversary. I mean, do you think that's fair?
Well, I don't know how I would say it. The point is that Putin, an ex-KGB man, educated in that kind of police mentality, control of one thing or another, in my opinion, Yeltsin actually chose Putin. He was the right man for the moment because they were in chaos and you needed somehow to get control back for Russia. And because of all his contacts with the KGB all around, he was able to say to them, you know, get hold of this situation. But now, in my opinion, he's got, you know, he's trying to re-establish what has changed forever. And the Russians have always wanted somebody to tell them what to do, whether it's the Tsar or anybody else. They need to be told what to do. And I think Putin is totally out of date. He won't last too long. Maybe assassinated for all we know. Wouldn't surprise me. But anyway, he is in total command of that situation. But they signed their pledges, their agreements, never keep to them. So,
well, they would say the same about NATO, wouldn't they, with the expansion eastwards of NATO? Because when the Berlin Wall fell, there was a promise, apparently, from NATO to say, well, we won't expand eastwards, and of course they have done.
Yes, but when you say expand, it's not that. Don't forget, we've been reacting to the countries like Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, and places like that, where there is a portion of the population are Russian-speaking. And of course, it's a very interesting thing for somebody like a politician to say, we are there to do so-and-so. That was our country, and we're going to take it back again. So we've for instance, Putin was invited to go to NATO. He was invited to go to NATO. He was taken there and saw the whole thing. Because we wanted, you know, total cooperation. But there, what's he doing? Goes into Ukraine. Goes into the Crimea. He's already signed the agreements that they wouldn't do so.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I don't want to get too far into this, but I mean, he would say actually it's the European Union and NATO that have come into Ukraine. NATO are now in there training Ukrainian troops.
Yeah, of course, and they need to be training the otherwise Ukraine will suddenly go back.
Anyway, let's get back to you. And
very unimportant in all of this.
How did you get from the army into start working in the media then?
Yes, well that's quite interesting. Yes, I could tell you that story actually because it's quite amusing. I was in the theatre, and one day somebody said to me casually, well, if you're really interested in television, this new medium now, which was black and white at the time, there's only one person I know who might be able to help you. He's a very nice man. His name was Leslie Mitchell, and he was the Dimbleby of the pre-war years. He did movie tone news and things like that. He was rather austere, always dressed in a three-piece suit and black and one thing or another, Brill cream on his hair and everything else, and he had a commanding voice, and he was sort of, you know, Mr. BBC on that. And so they said, see if you can get an interview with Mitchellettes before ITV opened. So I managed to get there eventually, and it was in Ad Astra House, which was the previous headquarters of the RAF. And I went in there, and quite amazing, I went into the office. There was a chap, very well dressed, sort of English country gentleman type, small, standing behind the desk at the elbow of Leslie Mitchell. And as I walked in, I had a quick glance round, and there was a man with a wheelbarrow going past the window outside on the scaffolding with cement. It was so totally unprepared for starting in 1 week's time, you see. And Leslie Mitchell suddenly barked at me, "And what have you come to sell?" And I looked at him and I said, "Efficiency, Mr. Mitchell." "What?" I said, "Efficiency, Mr. Mitchell." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You've got a program that you're going to put on every day as from next week called Visitor of the Day. I notice that your telephones aren't even yet connected to the wall." That's actually how I started. And I left the office with a contract for the first 3 months to provide the people for him. That's how I actually got in. And, you know, it was one thing and another. It was a wonderfully, period of time with everything up and tackling the BBC.
I suppose you must have known that, you know, this was a new medium. There was lots of a big future for television. So what was the company you were working for and how did it develop?
Well, I was working, I got a letter, funnily enough. I received a letter. I was very young, lived in my little flat in Westminster, and suddenly one day a letter arrived, and it said, "I don't know whether you are presently employed, but I am the administrative director of ABC Television, you may not have heard of. If you'd be interested in a job, please contact my office and come and see us."
So you were headhunted?
I was headhunted, and actually, funny enough, not in a way like headhunting is today, with all the, you know, the terribly minute background detail and everything else. What it transpired was that everything was so disorganised at that time, fighting to get ITV on the thing, and they had a problem in certain department, a real problem. And the man who was the chief of administration had a friend who is the managing director of another television company who is in charge of all the sales, and they were having lunch together, and my chap said, "I've got an awful problem in so and so," and this chap said, "Well, I have to sell against another man and he usually wins, and if you've got a problem, I think that he might be the chap to do it for you." And that's how it happened. I even met him once, shook hands with him, very nice chap, and actually I owe my total future to that one chap, and after that letter out of the blue. But when I had my interview with this the director of administration, his name was Ronnie Dickinson, became the head of a major advertising agency, he looked at me because he'd done his research, and he said, "Barry, I know you in the SAS, but I am not involved with private armies." In other words, he's just saying, you know, you must behave as I want you to behave in a normal way. There's no sort of outlandish thing. You deal with the situation, but deal with it properly. We don't want any trouble. I said, "I quite understand."
So what were the achievements of ABC then?
Well, there were many achievements of ABC, because we were only on television for the weekends, Saturday and Sunday, in Manchester, the North, Yorkshire and Birmingham. And our studios, in fact, were at Teddington Lock, still there now, but no longer, of course, that company. And we had the weekend franchise, which we shared with Granada in the North, very strange setup, and with ATV in London. So we were a large company because we were part of EMI, but we were the junior members of it. So we had to really be pretty good at programming. And therefore, for instance, you won't remember it, but Armchair Theatre, we took Sidney Newman, who was with the BBC, he came to us, a Canadian, of, I think, Romanian extraction. He was a breath of fresh air in that situation. And we then had the Avengers, of course, which was a great success. And the other thing that we were pretty good at was outside broadcasts, church services, all programs that came you know, within the long, big area of Midlands, North and Yorkshire.
The Avengers is an interesting one because it's got a lot of affection from people that remember it when it was first broadcast, but it's also got a big following amongst young people who've picked it up as a almost something from the golden age of television.
Well, I had lots of problems with the Avengers in one way and another, but I was responsible. I'm not saying in a boasting way at all, but my staff, shall we put it that way, were responsible for launching it. And it was, of course, new, leather, you know, clad girls, and as a sort of an opposite situation, you had the impeccable Patrick McNee with his bowler hat and his beautiful suits and his umbrella with which he dealt with all the difficult people he had to deal with. And he, in fact, had been in motor torpedo boats in the war and fought with Scott against the German E-boats. So he was a very suave, laid-back chap in his own personality. Years later, this is just a little sideline, I was going to America, and I had been responsible. In fact, I started up the merchandising concepts for ABC. When I started it off, it didn't make very much money, but we were gradually getting it under control. So when I was over in Hollywood, I rang up Pat and said, "Pat, I'm in town." You see, he said, "Right, let's meet for lunch." I said, "Well, thank you very much. I'd love to do that." And we went to a restaurant. And sort of opening conversation, we hadn't seen each other for 20 years. We sat down there. It was actually nearly empty. I wasn't sure whether I was the host or the guest, but he was always very good like that. He would usually pay. And so we were talking. He said, "Ben, I must tell you something. You know all those dreadful things you made us do with the merchandising, the photographs, the leather, and you did a fashion show in New York. You remember the one in Paris?" I said, "I'll never forget it." He said, "We'll pay a car down." That was a story in itself. But he said, "The other day," he said, "I had a brown paper envelope from London." I said, "Yes." He said, "Now, I tell you what happened." He said, "We never got paid for merchandising. And for the last series, I was interviewed by Howard Thomas, the managing director, and I was trying to pick up something to make some more money. And I said to him, 'Listen, Howard, why can't I have a share in all this merchandising that Barry makes us do?' And he said, 'Well, I think that's quite fair, yes.' He said, 'What do you want?' He said, 'Well, I don't know, 5% or whatever it was, you see.' He said, 'Barry, when I opened the envelope the other day, he said there was a cheque for $250,000. I said to him, 'Lunch is on you, Pat.'"
What was the thinking behind the series? Because it's got echoes with, as I say, young people today still. Yes. And it was extremely successful. It almost, you can almost say single-handedly, got people, but making, you know, made sure there was a TV in every house. Everyone wanted to watch it.
I think that probably was true. We really put a huge effort into the publicising of it. And I had a wonderful press officer. She was a New Zealand girl, lady. And she was, the education in New Zealand is very high. She was a very good writer, very good organiser. And she sat down and wrote a background of all the personnel that were going to appear in the Avengers. And she was the one that thought up the name Emma Peel, the girl with man appeal. It was her. And so they had decided roughly on the thing, and she embellished it. And I think a great deal, I mean, she's been gone a long, long time now, but a great deal of credit went to hers. And when we had a budget, I remember, for photographics for 500, very, very little. We didn't spend much. And she came into me once and she said, "Barry, I've taken on," I can't remember his name just in this interview straight off, but he was the number one photographer in England, you know. I said, good God, how much is that going to cost? She said, £100. I said, £100? I said, that's the budget for a month. You can't do that for £100. She said, Barry, we've got to do it. And I said, okay, well, go ahead.
Now, tell us about some of your own films, because I know that you've been behind, anyway, at least several, one of which was called Count Five and Die.
Yes, well, Count Five and Die was another one of the little miracles that I've been blessed with during my life. Upon Ruchin, his name is Ernest Hecht, and his company's called Souvenir Press. He's just celebrating next week his 65 years in book publishing. He and his family escaped. I don't know if it was Austria or Czechoslovakia. I think it was Austria. And I was then in television. And I knew everybody, quite honestly. I knew most of the key people in the world at that time, from Prime Minister, anybody that we wanted to get. We usually knew how to get hold of them. And he once rang me up and he said, Barry, he said, I wonder if you can help me very kindly. There's an American colonel in London from the OSS, and they're working on a new film or something. And he said, can you possibly see if you can find him for me? Well, I said, I'll try. So I did. I found him in a little flat in Belgrave Square. And so I said, here's his telephone number to Ernest. There's his address. Bye-bye. He said, well, no, don't leave me like that. He said, I want you to go and see him. I said, what for? He said, I thought we should do a book on all this. Oh, dear God. So I went down to see him and I said, you know, would you be interested in a book of this story? And he said, well, I think I might. But he said, I don't think they'll grant it to me because of the film. And so I said, let me have a look at the contract that you've got. He's a very nice chap. He was a colonel in the OSS and a treasurer. And he showed it to me, the contract, and I said, does it say anything about books in this contract? So, yes. So he said, listen, there's a board meeting of 20th Century Fox this afternoon. He said, why don't we go there? I mean, I hardly knew him. I'm a young nothing at 25 or whatever it was. So I said, well, okay. So suddenly their board meeting was on, and there's a man called Spyros Skouros, who is the chairman of 20th Century Fox. And he was sitting at the top of a big boardroom table with about 30 other people there. Being an American, this colonel didn't worry about that, just opened the door, walked in, which nobody would do in any English company, said, hi. You see, they all looked up. And he started telling them that would anyone be interested in a book on this, you see? And all the executives said, no, certainly not. All these are our rights. We own everything, you see. And I had brought copies of the contract. So I said, well, I've got copies of the contract here. Could I pass them out? And I shelled them out, you see. And Spyros Skouros, who had a huge head, and I remember black glasses that went right across the top of his head. And I saw him slowly take one of these copies, you see, and he started looking. All the executives said, it's out of the question, Bill. No way. And all of a sudden, Spyros Skouros said, the boy's right. He's got the rights. Bill, if you want to do it, go ahead. And that's how I got. So I then go back with some sort of, I didn't know anything about this sort of thing. And I rang up my dear Ernest, great friend, of a lifelong friend. And I said, Ernest, apparently, we can do it. He said, he'll come to the office and get a contract and get it signed. I said, yes, but what's in this? He said, then write it, and you've got 4 weeks to do it in. I said, don't be ridiculous. I've never written a book in my life. I took 6 weeks because I just got the job with television, and I had to work all night for 6 weeks to do it. And I produced it. And I sent it to Ernest. He didn't write back or anything like that. The manuscript, a dreadful story of how it was all thrown together. And after about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I thought, why haven't I heard from Ernest? I mean, I didn't think he'd like it, but what changes is he going to ask for, you see? So I rang him up. I said, Ernest, I'm so nervous. always waiting for some money from somewhere out of the blue, you see. And I said, Ernest, what do you think of the magazine? He said, think of it. He said, is it the printers? I said, good God. He said, we're off.
The film, you can still watch. It's probably not quite so easy to get hold of the book. But where does the term Count Five and Die come from?
It's when agents had a tooth with the cyanide inside it. When all else fails, they decide that it's best to go. You bite on the tooth, cyanide goes in, count five, and you've gone.
What about The One Against the Wind? How did that happen?
The One Against the Wind. Hold on a second, I've got to think about this. Yes, The One Against the Wind. How did I get onto that? All these things happen by strange roundabout ways. But I met, actually through my sister Davina, who lived in Paris, this wonderful, wonderful English woman, Mary Lindell. And she actually became really, I think I could say, my surrogate mother after many, many, many years. She was extremely difficult. She got the quadriga in the First World War, the quadriga in the Second World War. She got Russian, the Order of St. Anne or something of Russia for her bravery in the First World War when she went onto the battlefield to collect the wounded. And she served throughout the First World War as a nurse. Then by the time of the Second World War, she was living in Paris with her three children. And one of her sons, in fact, was walking along in Paris after the Germans arrived and saw a man who was perfectly obviously an Englishman standing on the corner looking rather dazed. And as they walked by, he said, "You English?" And he said, "I am." He said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I'm trying to escape." So he said, "Well, I better take you to my mother." And that's how she started off her her escape line, right down to Spain. And she got mostly pilots, because it was found out, it was realised in Britain, that a pilot takes roughly 2 years to train properly, if it's done really properly, send them to Canada doing all the things that they have to do. Of course, it was much down when we started losing so many of our fine pilots. But it was realised that it's better to spend £10,000 in gold coins or things like that to get an escape pilot out of France or wherever, get them back to England into a Spitfire, which Beaverbrook had, you know, made certain there were plenty of. And so the escape lines gradually built up, and in many cases, within 12 weeks of having parachuted out of their blazing plane, they were back in a seat in a Spitfire in England. Cost 10,000, if may not even cost that, but that's what it roughly cost. And she was one of them. There were many, many escape lines, of course, but she was one of the first ones. So she used to dress in her Red Cross uniform from the First World War. She, terrible French, the way she spoke it, in an English accent and all this, but absolutely arrogant, and she actually went to Stupnagel, the commander of Paris, demanding the passes, the Ausweis, to take all these young babies across the border into free France, as it then was. And he gave it to her. And that's how she started off.
But she ended up, didn't she, in a concentration camp?
Yes, she did. Yes, and it was very miraculous she got away.
I mean, many people would say, how did she survive? But once the Germans found out that she'd been involved in some way.
She was shot, of course, in the place. She was going for her execution, and she was taken by two SS guards, and she realised that it was the end. So she thought, well, when this train gets down to a slower speed on a hill somewhere, I'm going to dash for it. And so she pretended she wasn't feeling well and she's going to be sick. And eventually she kept on acting up to these two people. And she said, I can't with the handcuffs on. Please just undo my handcuffs so that I can go to the toilet. I'm going to be sick. And of course they fell for it. So they undid her thing, you see. So she went out of the carriage and then probably stupidly, made a dash for the end of the carriage, where, you know, at the end of the French train there's an open piece there with a rail round, did you see, to throw herself out. But when they saw that she'd taken to her heels to get away, so they took out their shots, and she was hit three times by their bullets, thrown out onto the side. The train was stopped. She telescoped her neck. She was badly, badly injured. And they took her to a Luftwaffe hospital. And in a Luftwaffe hospital was a surgeon whose son was in the Luftwaffe, and her son was in the other side in England as an officer. And he put her together again. The Luftwaffe surgeon put her together again. But directly they did that, they then decided, we've got enough with this terrible, wicked woman. And we were sent to a concentration camp. That's where she landed up in Ravensbrück, where Violette Sabo, the very famous... was she Pakistan? I'm not quite sure where she was murdered there. And it was a terrible thing. She nearly didn't get away, but she worked eventually as a nurse for a German surgeon. His name was Treiter. And she hated the Germans, absolutely hated the Germans. But she worked for him as an assistant. And in the end, interestingly enough, they were all captured, of course, and he was to be tried. And when she gave her evidence to the British, they decided that he hadn't committed any crime there. He, you know, it wasn't bad, so bad, and that they would let him go to Switzerland, let him get away with it, on her evidence. But he said, no, I haven't done anything wrong. I've just done what I did. I haven't killed anybody, anything else. I've just been doing the best I can. And so he said, I'm perfectly happy to stand trial. He stood trial and was found guilty and was committed. And then he committed suicide, I think. So there was another guard in the thing, the man called Flum, who is an absolute dreadful SS man. And he thought he'd get away with it. And she was brought in as a prosecuting witness. And in the trial, he came in, and because she had just previously gone for the defence of Treiter, because she thought it was wrong, he thought that she would do the same for him. And the prosecution eventually, they asked, did you see this man ever do anything was incorrect, or whatever, however they did it, you see? And she said, yes, I did. And what did you see? I saw an old lady fall out of line, and he went across and stamped on her skull.
That was Barry Wynn, the author and filmmaker, and someone who was involved in the very early days of commercial television here in Britain, working as one of the central people doing the press for ATV in London. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Steve Norman from Avonmouth, and also Anthony Palmer. Finally, Barry Wynn, who's the author and filmmaker, one of the originators of commercial television at ATV in London. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.